Okay, Matthew, I'm sorry to have kept you waiting, but I hope it was interesting. I'm pretty sure it was interesting, don't you think?
Yeah, it was actually very pleasurable to be kept waiting in this instance.
Shall we pick up where we left off just now, or do you want to start with the Great Reset and the Malthusian religious-like commitment to closed systems, etc.?
Well, you know, I think that based upon what I just listened from Alex, a whole slew of new thoughts awoke in my mind, which caused me to rather restructure a lot of what I was going to say. And take a little bit more of a step back than I was going to. And you know how I love context and I love history, but Alex just opened up new vistas to explore. So I thought that we would try something new. On the note of party politics, the thing that here, speaking from Canada, that I wanted to just chime in on, when you do look at Commonwealth countries, parliamentary democracies, it is absolutely true. The Achilles heel is in the party politics system, that you are beholden tyrannically to whatever consensus is there in your party. So if you try, as let's say a conservative or a liberal individual with a conscience, to stand up and say, I don't agree with bombing this country or this dictatorial policy, you're out of your party. I mean, there's a whip literally there, and that's the position to whip you into place. Whereas in a republic, you can have parties, but it is not a party system. You can stand up as a Republican, as we saw Ron Paul do on many occasions, in opposition to bombing poor countries on the other side of the world, despite the fact that his party was promoting it. And that is defended, your right to stand for your conscience. George Washington, when you look at some of the original speeches by Washington himself, he warned that one of the points of corruption of the United States would be that it fall into a party political dynamic, and the tendency to fall into mob rule, right, where you stop thinking as a sovereign individual, a citizen, and you instead allow a mob to replace your personal morality, your personal ability to think and speak. So this is a long fight. And people think, oh, America was always a party system. No, it was not. And then when you look at other people like John Quincy Adams, the great American ambassador to Russia, who became president, he was somebody who also warned that America must never go about looking for monsters to destroy. That it would be, as earlier people like John Winthrop had made a point, a city on a hill. You would assist in other countries' aspirations, but you would not go about trying to intervene on other countries' internal domestic problems. The British Empire, which always was a supranational empire, was never, and I think Alex has made the point with UK column, the British Empire was never something that was purely emanating from the British nation. It was always, it was willing to destroy British people as much as it was Africans, Indians, Irishmen, or Americans. It didn't really matter. As long as this was a supranational, above nations entity that would have penetrations utilizing its controls of finance. The City of London, like today, was back then still a nerve center of global commerce, global finance. This is not a new thing. Its controls of intelligence agencies, the ability to create various fifth columns in various countries that you wish to undermine from within. This is what the American Revolution both broke free from, but also what tried to pull America back into its fold. I mean, people think, oh, you know, just like after World War II, Britain after 1776 or 1783, they just let America go free. And America, this is the simplistic education we Canadians often get, our British education, that America just became immediately the new slave-owning, white supremacist society of individualism, that we Canadians, we kept our hands clean of that and never had a dirty revolution. Thank God, praise the Queen. No. The fact was that Britain never forgave the rebellious colony because there was an example that had been set for other countries to also become republics, to stand on their own two feet. And I think most importantly, to adopt political economic systems that would involve national controls of banking, the emission of public credit for great projects that would uplift the quality of people's lives, both spiritually, mentally, and physically. Great infrastructure projects were never done by purely letting, you know, the private financiers just do something. Private financiers on their own never allowed for any nation to develop infrastructure in that way. So it was always done by this type of program, this long-term thinking, 10, 20-year programs. So there was always a fight to, on the one hand, reabsorb corrupt nations like America, like countries that had been inspired by the U.S. example, to destroy them and reabsorb them. And I just mentioned 1945 quickly, and I didn't follow up on that. We're often told that Britain stopped being an empire also. That's another mythology of history in 1945. And they decided to let, you know, America coming out of World War II was going to be the new global, new British Empire. And Britain just let their colonies go free. And, you know, now it's been this unidimensional America bad empire. And this is this very simplistic history we've been fed decade after decade, and it's wrong. And the good thing, I think, with our current crisis is it's shocked a lot of people to begin thinking more about the nuance than they had been formerly when times were apparently a little bit more stable. There are, at recent terms, deep state has been a term often used and bandied about, and that's a fine term to use, but that there are these two Americas fighting each other. What was it that killed John F. Kennedy? What was it that killed his brother? What about what was Franklin Roosevelt and Henry Wallace trying to do in opposition to Churchill and Keynes and the British Empire earlier, when before Roosevelt died while in office, and Henry Wallace was essentially destroyed and called a red commie? What about Warren Harding, who died also in office in 1923? What about McKinley, who died in 1901? What was he doing? What was Warren Harding and McKinley doing? To revive Abraham Lincoln's system of protective tariffs, of credit emissions through new types of state banking for big projects, helping other countries to stand on their own two feet. Lincoln himself, what was he doing? Did he have a global process in his mind as well as something that America could help to liberate the world, not just itself of slavery, but the world of the slavery of colonialism, which he saw in his speeches. You could see this as two sides of the same thing. I skipped over Garfield, who also died in 1880. And, you know, we can go back to President Harrison in 1840, who died while fighting to revive the Third National Bank, which was it was passed in the Congress and the House of Representatives and the Senate. It was passed as a bill to revive a national bank, which was on his desk when he died after 3 months in office in 1840, or Zachary Taylor in 1851, who also died. Eight presidents and Bobby Kennedy. What was going on, right? There's this wonderful, wonderful, sometimes scary, but very empowering history that we're not given access to by this, again, imperial education system, which has glossed over and trashed the battles of history that would give us a sense of what to do, how to diagnose the current situation we live in today. So I do have some things I want to show. Just quickly, I want to just, as Alex was speaking, I decided that it would be appropriate, since we're now thinking about systems, not about pairwise interaction of parts, but rather systems as one singular chemistry, one periodic table of elements. So if you're going to look at one element or another, you cannot do it competently without having the whole in your mind. This is, I think, a good starting point based on what I just said, what Alex just said. In 1890, a map was produced by an individual named William Gilpin, whose work is, again, scrubbed out of history. This map was published in a book he wrote called The Cosmopolitan Railway. And as you can see, it says Gilpin's American Economic Just and Correct Map of the World. And I had seen this many years ago, and I just never really looked more into it. I thought it was an anomaly. But I didn't look into who Gilpin was. I didn't look into the world's chemistry of what was the potential, what was the fight in 1890. This is just a decade before William McKinley was killed. It was a decade after Garfield was killed. It was a decade after Tsar Alexander II was assassinated by an anarchist bomb. This was an age of assassinations. This was an age of potential before World War I and the color revolutions, which were sparked in Russia in 1905 and again in 1917, funded by people like Jacob Schiff. Even people like Lord Milner was a financier behind the Bolshevik Revolution originally, and that was its own story. But this is before that. So what does William Gilpin feature in his book? It's an interconnected network of rail and industrial corridors that he describes in depth, as well as the financing mechanisms of how this would be brought about, stretching through the Bering Strait. And what you see is a continuation of the transcontinental railway that Lincoln had begun in 1863, the same year that Tsar Alexander II had deployed the Russian Navy to the coasts of the United States during the Civil War, right when America, when Lincoln had invoked the greenback system to break free of private monopoly or private Wall Street and London banks that were trying to provide usurious, destructive loans. It would be impossible for the U.S. to take out to pay for the war. That, again, Britain had gone far to organizing as a divide-to-conquer strategy. So the extension of rail from the transcontinental that had been finished in 1869 through British Columbia, British Canada, through Alaska, that had been sold by the Russians in 1867 in May to the Americans, and then through the 100-kilometer gap and two little islands, Big and Little Diomede, into Russia, into Siberia, and down into Asia. And as you can see, there's a connecting line as well from Asia, from China, east-west through Europe, with connecting points through the Middle East, through India, as well as into Egypt and Africa. Gilpin understood things better than we do today. He was living it. He was living on the front lines. He was Lincoln's bodyguard. He was the first governor of Colorado Territory. He largely helped save the Union at a time when a Western Front was about to be opened by the Confederacy. And he, while governor, did save the Union there. He was known as the father of manifest destiny. He was the first and earliest champion of the, or among the first, of the transcontinental railway begun, that he began championing in 1840, 20 years before it was begun. And he was part of an international network of people in Russia. Keep in mind, the Trans-Siberian Railway was built with American-made cars and material from Philadelphia, Baldwin locomotives. That was what was rolling through Siberia in the early 1900s. Russia saved the United States largely by deploying their fleet. Why? To tell as a message to Britain and to French imperialists stationed in Mexico and in Canada that if they were to openly go now and back the Confederate South, this would be a casus belli against Russia. So there was a great brotherhood. People think of America-Russia relations purely from Cold War filters, and they forget that, no, the history of Russian-American relations were very different. And even, you know, going back another 80 years before this, or 100 years before this map was produced, it was Tsar Catherine the Great working through her collaborator, Ekaterina Dashkova, who was the president, the first female president of the Russian Academy of Sciences, who had organized the League of Armed Neutrality that ensured success for the American cause. This was largely a flank by Benjamin Franklin. So the idea of U.S.-Russia friendship, as well as Germany friendship, you know, keep in mind Otto von Bismarck was applying at this time as well the Frederick List system of protective tariffs, the Zollverein, the customs union. This was done by Frederick List, the economist who had studied in the United States, who had studied Alexander Hamilton's solutions to the early chaos years after the American Revolution. And List, after returning back to Germany from 5 years of studying in the United States in the 1830s, was able to provide this gateway to unify the atomized, Germany was not a nation state in that period. And it was unified by a protective tariff with free trade within, but a protective tariff from without to prevent from the dumping of cheap goods or speculative attacks by the City of London that had always kept Germany at war with itself and underdeveloped. And internal improvements like rail, industrial development internally with state credit. So this was done with the American model of political economy in mind that Lincoln had done, that Germany had done, that Russia had done. Mendeleev, I brought up chemistry. Dmitry Mendeleev, the founder of the periodic table, who worked very closely with Sergei Vita, the premier of Russia, the finance minister, who largely orchestrated much of the Trans-Siberian Railway. Mendeleev himself was on the committee. He was the head of the committee for the protective tariff of Russia. He came to the United States in 1876 for the centennial with thousands of other delegates from around the world, from Japan, from France. Sadi Carnot's cabinet, like Gabriel Haneteau, studied this. And they brought back the experience of how the Americans were able to recover from their civil war so quickly and become the industrial leader. What was their policy? What was the spirit? What was the philosophical way of thinking that allowed this? And it was done internationally. Now, the thing I want to point out is that though Alexander II and the Third both died, both likely, I mean, one guaranteed by assassination, the second one likely by arsenic poisoning in the late 1890s, there was still momentum to connect the rail through the Bering Strait. And even Nicholas II, all the way until March 1906, had funded American engineers to do surveying on the connection of the Bering Strait Railway. So this was moving very close. And this is, again, Vita's brainchild. Along with Gilpin. So here, I'm just going to do a stop share. So what you had was potential being actualized for a world, a community of sovereign nation states, a family of republics working on win-win cooperative benefit. So the idea was that you didn't, to get the British system was always founded upon a worshiping of money and getting people to, on the one hand, divide themselves both physically and also intellectually, right? Be divided in many ways, metaphysically as well as physically, so that they would be better conquered. This other type of system was based upon an idea that was more than the sum of its parts, that the whole, that if you were going to get wealth, you didn't have to steal it from somewhere in a zero-sum game. That's the imperial view of wealth, is if I'm going to be wealthy, there's only a limited amount of the pie is only so big. So if I'm going to have more pie, someone else must have less pie. The American system, which this goes back even before this to Colbert's of France. It had been something that had been evolving and finding new modes of expression for many, many centuries, even before the revolution. This is a different idea, that there was a gestalt, that society as a whole, the world was like a gestalt, a thought, which was, by its definition, more than the sum of the parts, right? The body of humanity is more than the cells of the individual body. There's something, there's a life spirit, a metaphysical essence that gives vitality and purpose and design and harmony to the parts and how they work together. So nation states and the science of economy were understood in very similar terms. This is something which the previous speaker, Alex, had brought up the example of the 1922 Rapallo Accords. If you look at who was organizing the Rapallo Accords that would have put an end to the hyperinflationary blowout of Germany and also basically wiped out the Versailles Treaty unpayable debt payments, as I've also gone through in my previous presentation, you had people like Walter Rathenau, the finance minister, and his assistant, Kurt von Schleicher, both played an instrumental role in that. At that time in 1922-23-24, this is again German-Russian relations that were the key backbone to a new world that could have been brought online. You also had Warren Harding in the United States fighting against the League of Nations at this very same time, who had not yet died of oyster poisoning on a train from Alaska. You had over 300 German statesmen at this period who were assassinated by anarchist deployments. And anarchism was something that had been developed and honed from the 1800s by people like Giuseppe Mazzini, Lord Palmerston, who had organized a European-wide and American-wide array of young Europe movements. Young America movements became things like the Confederacy, young Americans as part of the Giuseppe Mazzini Freemasonic Network, which Palmerston largely led, who was the head of the British Empire. These were people like Albert Pike, the Confederate general who went far to establish the KKK terrorist organization inside of the USA, who had reorganized Scottish Rite Freemasonry under his morals and dogma. This is what was brought in as a secret police force after McKinley was murdered with J. Edgar Hoover, who became a leading figure within this as well throughout the much of the 20th century. So you have this coalition. What was Lord Mackinder, who was a leading Fabian who worked very closely with Lord Milner? What was Lord Mackinder writing about before in the days and months and even years before World War I was sparked artificially? He was warning of the danger, the greatest danger to the British Empire's existence. And keep in mind, the British Empire is a maritime empire. It can only control the world. This tiny little sociopathic network on a tiny little island could only control the world by keeping everyone dependent on unpayable rates of debt slavery and maritime sea trade, that the British controlled all of the major 9 or 10 choke points of maritime trade. If nations began to develop their internal capacities through rail development, industrial development, they would break free if they utilized their rights as a sovereign nation to cancel unpayable usurious debt or emit national credit for projects backed by the nation itself. Then that would break nations free of Britain's control. So what did Mackinder say was the greatest threat to the British Empire? A Russia, German, US alliance. The people who were organizing the Rapallo Accord were people from Germany who were part of the Frederick List Society. The Frederick List movement was very strong internationally, including in Asia. People like Sun Yat-sen, you know, just to put this in mind as well, right? The Chinese Revolution of 1911, organized by Sun Yat-sen, who was a Christian, who had studied in the United States, who brought back an understanding and a strategy into China to overthrow the hereditary systems of the Manchu dynasties. And he brought in a system that he called the Three Principles of the People. He had studied Hamilton, he had studied Lincoln, he had studied Frederick List, and he was clear about the importance of a protective tariff and great projects, like he was even talking about in his International Development of China in 1919. He warned of trusting the British that would carve up China quickly if the intelligentsia of China would be so stupid as to work with the British after the century of humiliation that was still happening, and the Opium Wars and everything else had carved up Britain, right? And he had in his International Development of China programs of rail and industrial development in ports that involved reawakening the old ancient Silk Road. That was there in his 1911 book, animated by his studies of Lincoln's A Principle of a Nation for, by, and of the People. That would be the animating principle that would make this work. Unfortunately, he died a little bit too young. Unfortunately, Warren Harding died too young, and so did Rathenau, and so did many others. But still, despite that, the push for a one-world government was still subverted in 1919, right? The League of Nations was always supposed to be a one-world government to replace the sovereign nation-state system. And people forget that. And they think often from our world, in the world that we live in, that the empires had all of this control for so long. And it's like, my response is, you know, they've been planning this for generations and generations. And it's like, yeah, okay, there's been a continuity of evil intention. But if they had all of the control that so many people attribute to them, then why didn't they win? Why are we not all dead? Yeah. Why didn't they succeed really in their objectives?
Course.
Yeah, exactly. It's obvious, right? It should be obvious, but it has to be explicit. So it failed because there were American patriots fighting behind the scenes. There were European patriots and others, Chinese patriots fighting against things like the League of Nations and Article 10 of the League of Nations. That was a collective security pact binding any member of the League militarily into supporting the entire war, just or unjust, that would be sparked. So that failed. It was again attempted in 1922-23 with the London Conference that I went through a few months ago. These are all features in my book series on the Clash of the Two Americas. But the League of Nations and the Bank of England and the Bank of International Settlements again tried to get rid of nation states during the height of the Great Depression. And their solution was a central banker's dictatorship by the technocratic enlightened few that would know how to manage the levers of commerce from London. That was the London Conference of 1933. Why did it not succeed? It did not succeed because Franklin Roosevelt, who was the only anti-fascist option, all of the people who had organized, the senators, the bipartisan congressmen who had organized against the League of Nations since the death of Warren Harding, they had all mobilized around getting Roosevelt elected, who sabotaged that conference. He pulled the U.S. out of all discussion for an international bankers program. He basically said, no, we're not going to do this. And the response was a near assassination attempt in February of 1933 by an anarchist Freemason who tried to shoot Roosevelt. His hand was hit in the audience while he was shooting, and he shot Mayor Cermak of Chicago, killed him. And again, the same fascists who are working with their London fascists and with the German fascists, people like Prescott Bush, like the Harrimans, who would many of the people like Schiff, the Morgan machine that had initiated, orchestrated the Great Depression, the bubbles popping in the 1929 period, who had funded the Bolshevik Revolution earlier, who had these individuals tried to get a military dictatorship with Smedley Butler, the general, to basically overthrow the government and install a puppet dictator, which anybody can go to YouTube and listen to this brave General Butler educate the people of America in 1934-35 about what had happened, how was he being deployed, and how did he blow the whistle on this fascist machine inside of America that was running think tanks like the American Liberty League that was trying to keep America out of the war. Why? Because they had a very, very clear plan. And Alex Craner, who I also interviewed, Alex Craner did a wonderful trilogy on the trifold agenda for a new world order, which would involve an Anglo-American control of much of Europe and the Americas, a German control of the heartland, you know, Mackinder's heartland, who controls the heartland, controls the world, which would involve utilizing the Slavs as the slave labor society, for the Lebensraum. The Japanese would have the Asia Pacific or much of it. Britain would control. Lord Halifax himself documented his own discussions working with Neville Chamberlain, and he had discussions with Hitler, and Halifax directly described there's records of these transcripts of his understanding with the Germans, the Nazis, that, you know, Britain would, they were the best at controlling India. They would control much of Africa. Germany would control the heartland. And this was going to, and the American fascists of Wall Street, who were always beholden since 1776, there were always United Empire loyalists that had established Wall Street as a British fifth column within the United States. They always were going to control a fascist USA, and probably some of Latin America too. That would, a lot of that would be Franco and Mussolini would also get chunks. So there was a whole blueprint that didn't work. Why didn't it work? Again, Roosevelt declared war. He broke up the banks. He used the Constitution as an active document, not just as ink on paper, and forced a breaking up of speculative from commercial banks. He forced these bankers to go to court. Many bankers went to prison. This is unheard of today, since, you know, it's been 13 years since the blowout of Lehman Brothers, 14 years. And no major banker, no major player has seen any punishment whatsoever. In fact, they've just gone around and created a completely new system. So this didn't happen. Again, there was an agenda to create a post-war age. And there was a fight. And this is, again, the topic of my volume two of the Clash of the Two Americas. There was a fight over whether it was going to be an Anglo-American run new empire, which is what Churchill wanted, or Keynes had wanted as well. America had come out of the war as the only industrially powerful country. Everyone else was crippled. Or would it be Franklin Roosevelt's vision of converting the U.S. military into an arsenal of democracy and utilizing the Bretton Woods institutions at the time, the World Bank, the IMF, the GATT, the UN? Would these be utilized as instruments to extend productive credit internationally to assist nations in developing their own Tennessee Valley authorities, rural electrification projects for Africa, India, China, South America, and beyond, as well as the Marshall Plan? There are clear battle lines that were drawn, and the U.S. delegations were totally in support of helping countries stand on their own two feet and develop their own industrial sovereignty so that they would no longer be reliant on the British. Keynes had lost those battles at Bretton Woods. However, as I said earlier, Roosevelt died. He died too soon. His allies were purged. They were called Red Commie Traitors and were witch hunted very quickly. Wallace did try, despite that, to run as a third party candidate, as a Progressive Party candidate with Paul Robeson, the great baritone singer and activist. That didn't work. There was a lot of FBI sabotage, CIA sabotage. And this is a period when the Cold War, the Americans are forgetting that just moments ago, they were allies working as brothers with the Russians who had sacrificed, had 25 million of their people die. The Americans lost 450,000. The Chinese lost 10 million in World War II. They'd forgotten all of that very quickly into the propaganda campaign run by the reconstituted Liberty League apparatus, which didn't really disappear, as we are told, in 1940 when America entered the war. They just simply changed their veneer, and they immediately went to work creating the Cold War, right? And the Anglo-American alliance. Nuclear bombs were unnecessarily dropped on defeated Japan as a direct message to the Russians to say, all of the plans and hopes you had with Roosevelt, those are off now. It's a new game in town. And people like Bertrand Russell were even promoting the idea of utilizing America's third nuclear weapon that hadn't been used on the Soviet Union that had just lost 25 million people. Bertrand Russell had even said, use this as a threat to get them to submit to one world government. So there was a derailment of history, of this beautiful world of win-win cooperation twice, right? Three times, one in 17 after the American Revolution. This was an international network of people who wanted to create a new paradigm. In 1776 to 83, I didn't even mention Haider Ali from southern India, who had organized the rebellion in the 1780s and 90s against the British Empire that had managed to pull 20% of the British Navy into trying to suppress the Haider Ali Muslim rebellion. And Haider Ali's son, Tipu Sultan, a leader of the rebellion, had sent letters in 1780s to the Continental Congress of Washington saying, we are in this together as one fight. You had Sidi Mohammed, of the Emperor of Morocco, who had provided protective, he basically protected American ships during the American Revolution from Barbary pirates who were working for the British Empire. You had Poland, Polish Republicans, German Republicans, Scharnhorst. You had so many, Marquis de Lafayette from France, and many more, many 20 Irish generals who all fought with the American Revolution. It was meant to be a global new paradigm for the creative evolution of humankind out of the system of empire and into an age of moral reason. And again, with William Gilpin a century later, and the what we saw with that image that I had shown of this map of rail connecting the world with national banking, national economics, that was again subverted by an age of chaos, assassinations, color revolutions, and war. Again, this other near potential of an age of an international New Deal with the US, China, Russia bedrock. That was what Roosevelt had initiated, a US, China, Russia bedrock to replace the systems of empire forever and provide the means for nations to fish, not just give them fish. The Cold War derailed all of that. And again, what we saw was the Galen networks reconstituted by people like Alan Dulles, who had always been working behind the scenes with his brother, John Foster, and with this whole fifth column inside of the USA to create a nightmare. So this is what was reconstituted immediately in the wake of World War II, right, in West Germany. This is what was done with the Operation Gladio throughout the 1960s and 70s with terrorist cell operations that were carried out by Nazi stay-behinds protected by the CIA and MI6. So this is really a big chunk of that history. Now, in all of that process, I didn't mention anything about system how this is related to the Great Reset. I'll do that now. I had a whole PowerPoint. I'm not going to show it. It's not worth it. But the Great Reset is not something that just began in June 2020. This is something that was planned the moment John F. Kennedy was killed, when Enrico Mattei was killed, when Charles de Gaulle was ousted in an organized form of color revolution in France, when Bobby Kennedy was killed, when Martin Luther King Jr. was killed, and many others. I didn't even go into African, Pan-African movement leaders like Lumumba or Kwame Nkrumah's ouster. So in the 1960s, again, there was a fight that JFK had led to undo the Cold War by creating a U.S.-Russia alliance to build and cooperate on a common space program. The space program defined the entire economy. JFK was killed. That didn't happen. The moment Bobby Kennedy was killed and the Trilateral Commission came into official power, I mean, they were officially created in 1973, but really Kissinger, Zbigniew Brzezinski, David Rockefeller, they'd already been working very, very carefully in the late 60s with the RAND Corporation, with other groups inside of the United States think tanks to create artificial wars like the Vietnam War. And when, as soon as they got control in 1970-71 and lifted the dollar, floated it from the fixed exchange rate, killed the Bretton Woods basis of the fixed exchange rate global system of currencies, and floated the dollar onto the speculative markets. At that point, a new paradigm, a new set of rules, a new operating system was brought into place of deregulation. Increasingly speculation and momentary desires determine the value of commodities and currency. No longer was it based upon industrial production. And the world was put onto a post-industrial society. America was told that the industrial power you had, that's now a thing that you're going to export to poor countries who will be used for slave labor. They will not be permitted to develop. And instead, they will produce cheap stuff for us as consumers. And our new ethic will be a cult of consumerism. So this is a process where you could see the atrophy of investments into infrastructure, the maintenance or creation of new infrastructure went, it collapsed completely. NASA was gutted. It went from a 4% of GDP per budget down to less than 0.5% very quickly. And its peak was 3 years before the moon landing itself. That was the peak. It was cut every year ever since and kept always without mission, always without the means to actually carry out projects. Fusion energy funding was sabotaged, was funded. All funding was cut during this time. And so the idea was, okay, we will atomize the individuals. We'll atomize and balkanize the parts of the system, but we will keep maximum controls for the elite few of a technocratic priesthood. And this is where, if you look at the early days of the World Economic Forum, of people like Klaus Schwab, whose mentor was Henry Kissinger, keep in mind, right? Co-founded this, the World Economic Forum was co-founded by Maurice Strong. They were presided over early on by the leading figures like Alexander King of the Club of Rome, who had created, these were the new priests of the Malthusian priesthood that had tried to use computer modeling to determine maximum human population density called carrying capacity. And they said, this is what we're going to use as the governing class to manage the diminishing returns of resources in the system. So in that new age, this new post-1971 world, the economy itself was turned largely into a time bomb. We lost capitalism. It became a speculative bubble, and bubbles always burst, whether by design or whether by their own, just let them do their own thing. You blow a hubba bubba bubble gum too much at a certain point, that will blow up in your face. It's the nature of physics. It's like that for economy too. So you unbound speculation, you unbound, you basically say that vice is virtue, right? Making money is good. Don't think about the future. Don't think about the past. Just live in the now. And this type of hedonism, this new type of consumerism drove people rather mad, I think. And now we're living in the wake where even before coronavirus was sprung onto us, the economy was already going to collapse. Mervyn King, the former head of the Bank of England, had already warned in September of 2019 that we were on the cusp of a financial Armageddon. The bailouts had begun once again to pour emergency liquidity into the insolvent banks of Wall Street and also Europe, mostly Wall Street at the time. It was only, you know, this is before event 201 even. So everyone knows that the system, and everyone knew who was in a position to know that the system was going to collapse. It wasn't a matter of if, but a matter of when. And there has been a fight over who will control the terms and conditions and the rules of the new system. Will it be based upon a one world government, a technocratic feudal scientific priesthood, which wants to do what it had been trying to do, and all of those occasions that I just mentioned and that Alex went through? get rid of nation states, the best defense humanity has ever created for ourselves in opposition to the system of empire, which has always been a very centralized. I mean, empire is always a very, very centralized global system above nation states with a larger capacity, power to carry out chaos. So you do need, I would say that you do need nation states that have a power behind them, a central power to carry out as a weapon this fight against this type of parasitic supranational entity. Yeah. The national banking system is an important one. So I do think that that is an important thing to hold on to. Sorry, you were going to say something? I don't want to cut you off.
I was
going to
say, yes, I agree with that. But yeah. Inside these nation states, in order to have real true democracy, we have to have regional self-determination, so to speak. But you're right. It is not enough to be connected, to have all these regions connected with each other, but rather the nation states as a coherently organized group of people, basically, is the best defense against the globalists, right?
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's correct. Yeah, and in that sense, absolutely. The idea of a community of principle, a community of cooperating sovereign nation states is the key. It has to be the voluntaristic principle. You cannot force this type of, you cannot force virtue, right? Virtue is something innate.
Yeah.
So the idea now today, if you look at the configuration of the world as one chemistry, you certainly have not just a military encirclement of Russia. Russia has made very clear their demand for red lines to be respected, that NATO not encroach one more inch upon their border. We know that NATO has been installing so-called defensive anti-ballistic missiles, but these can easily be converted into offensive systems, which, when you look at the doctrine of full spectrum dominance that has been underway, or the idea of Zbigniew Brzezinski of flexible response, limited thermonuclear war that permits for a limited amount of collateral damage of European nations, allies that we can tolerate their being wiped out. But overall, some of these game theorists who are used to looking at the world from a Rand Corporation style video game. My wife is doing a wonderful study on the Rand Corp right now, and it's interesting. They look at the world like it's a video game. They think that a nuclear war is actually winnable under certain scenarios. They would rather it not happen. They would rather other scenarios occur instead. But this is still what is going on. And as well, it's not just Russia's perimeter, right? Look at any map. I actually have this in my PowerPoint. I didn't show it. But look at in the Pacific, right? There's over 100,000 U.S. troops stationed that were launched under Obama's Asia pivot. There are military bases in the Philippines, in South Korea, 28,000 troops, American troops in South Korea with THAAD missiles, both pointed at China and at Russia. You have 50,000 American troops in major military bases in Japan. There's a policy to absorb Taiwan as well as Ukraine into NATO-like, or in the case of the Pacific, it's a NATO of the Pacific that the Pentagon has created under Biden called the Quad. And the British have played a large role in this too, a NATO of the Pacific featuring India, Japan. They want Taiwan into this as well as a forward stationing as part of this encirclement, this containment, and a potential point of launch against both China and Russia, and many others. And within China, within Russia, you've had many other asymmetrical forms of warfare that have been going on for decades. That's why Russia has kicked out Soros and said that Soros is not allowed to set up his open society operations within Russian borders, because they were caught trying to do their color revolutions within Russia, within the white revolution of Moscow that was attempted. People like Navalny are entities that came out of this. In China as well, George Soros was kicked out in 1989 for a good reason. George Soros had actually worked to get his own puppet, Zhao Ziyang, to become the head of the Chinese Communist Party, and who he was the head of the government. It was a guy who co-ran a think tank with George Soros, bringing in open society, who tried to run a coup d'etat in 1989. We were told it's Tiananmen Square. It was actually a coup d'etat being run by the CIA. George Bush Sr., then, who had been the head of the CIA, was on the ground in Beijing just during that event. So was Gene Sharp, the father of color revolutions himself. So there was an attempt to create a complete Yeltsin-like breaking up, a balkanization of China back then, Zhao Jiang was the selected guy to privatize their central bank the way, you know, and they had been doing the same thing under Gorbachev and Yeltsin in Russia. This is the age of the end of history, right? The unipolar age was now upon us. The end of history was here. And unfortunately, Russia succumbed, and the 1990s was a disaster. George Soros' operations went into high momentum, and many of the Warsaw Pacts were all absorbed into NATO, as NATO's mission, its raison d'être, was destroyed, but it kept on encroaching on Russia's perimeter. And Russia has been working under Putin to heal itself, to fight back against this fifth column of these zombies from within who are still there. There's still a fight, obviously. China has also been fighting against their own fifth columns. So you have, but most importantly, Russia and China, as well as Iran, which has just signed a $400 billion deal recently with China, as well as another deal with Iran, has become a pillar of a new type of Eurasian multipolarity, a system of cooperation based on large-scale infrastructure projects, instead of speculating on fictitious capital. So China has built 40,000 kilometers of high-speed rail, the world's most fast magnetic levitation, and innovated in Germany. Yeah. Germans got rid of it. And they're extending it to other countries. Yeah, really, eh? But probably a sabotage, right? 20 people died in that prototype.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's been a conscious effort to induce advanced technologies to have mishaps and to create fear of technology, fear of power, fear of nuclear. Like, that's why, you know, there were sabotages and a variety of nuclear accidents as well, to induce fear so that people would stay within the controlled domain of windmills, solar panels, oil, coal, things that were monopolized, things that involved limits to our growth and adapting to this cage that would always be made smaller and smaller, as the great resetters today are wishing that we do, is to live in a world like animals where we adapt to a diminishing world that gets smaller. And unfortunately, some countries do not want to sacrifice their multi-thousands of year civilizations on the altar of Gaia, and are fighting for defining the terms and conditions of globalization 2.0, as my friend, or as my colleague, I shouldn't say my friend, but my colleague, Pepe Escobar, calls it, is globalization 2.0. This is a fight. There's a fight to bring this new system online. And what it's going to look like, what this is going to be, is still underdetermined, but the fight is on. The danger of war is real. But this history is very alive. It's not something that just happened in the past that we just study for trivia's sake. It's really something that's a living thing, active today. So I guess I would just end it there.
When you first said, you explained about the two Americas fighting each other, and you mentioned all these presidents plus Bobby Kennedy, who died in office, some of them obviously killed, others not so obviously, but maybe killed as well. Is that the fight of what they now call the deep state against the people who wanted a new world order for the greater good of people? Not money-based and not debt-ridden, but like the Roosevelt idea, the Great New Deal. Is that basically what this fight is about? If that's the case, then we really are dealing with a few crazy psychopaths who are trying to control the world against a much larger group of people who, unfortunately, seems to be, I don't know, naive, so as not to understand what this small group of people is trying to do.
That's not a bad way of thinking about it. I mean, yeah, I do think that when you have there's a difference between the rules-based international order of the unipolarists, like Anthony Blinken and these technocratic zombies, you know, that it doesn't mean anything. That's just basically saying the new world order with new words, where everybody just obeys the rules of the United States and Britain. Mm. I would say Britain because, I mean, at the end of the day, it's the financial oligarchy centered in London that has been running the USA. But whatever, we'll use words. The words are limited.
So it's the city of London, basically.
Yeah, and the whole apparatus associated with that. It's a multidimensional apparatus. But beyond that, you have those who are defending the United Nations Charter. So whenever you hear the leadership of Russia or China speaking about international law, they're always referring to the UN Charter. If you go to the UN Charter of Franklin Roosevelt, that this was his allies that organized the crafting of this. It was not the League of Nations. It was not the abolishment of sovereignty. It was, in fact, the principle of sovereignty is enshrined in the actual Constitution, in the Charter itself, the principle of non-intervention by any government into another government. These are principles that are embedded as these are absolutely true and very important. It's antithetical to the idea of the New World Order that necessitates a Hobbesian power impose itself onto the weak. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have right now, yes, a fight over two different operating systems. One is based upon an idea of a closed system, a zero sum game with diminishing returns for an ever small sociopathic elite. And the other one is based upon a non-zero-sum open system gain. One is entropic. One is governed by the rules of entropy of the second law of thermodynamics. It's like a machine, right? Mm-hmm. If you put a certain amount of gasoline into your tank, over time, as your pistons move and burn energy, there's always going to be less energy to go back into keeping the machine going. And it's going to be defined teleologically, like the future empty tank will be defining its moments, and it won't change its architecture or its design to become a better engine producing more energy. It'll always be dying. They assume that that's the machine of humanity, that ecosystems, human economies, even galaxies, they try to impose this type of system, closed system, anti-creative idea onto what they want to control. And in their world, no. New creative discoveries that human beings uniquely do when we are not thinking like computers. We make eureka leaps out of logical systems and into gestalts, right? Mm-hmm. Real creative thought concepts that are solution concepts, and translate that back into new technologies. This is something that they see as unnatural and disruptive to their equilibrium. They are committed religiously to mathematical equilibrium. That's like the priesthood of transhumanism. The fourth industrial revolution is a revolution of mathematical equilibrium. That's not the way the universe works. It is, by all evidence, it is a creatively moving directional universe that has purpose, order, harmony built into it. And we are a reflection of that creation that, you know, this is at the heart of the U.S. Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, yes. If you read those writings.
I completely agree with that. But that also means that they cannot win unless they keep us in the dark, which they obviously can't, because I think this time they have overplayed their hand by creating the plandemic, because now many people have been awake before, but more and more people are really waking up and asking questions and wanting to listen to what you have to say, what Alex has to say, to understand what is going on. Once you wake them up, once they start to ask questions, there's no stopping them. So I don't think they have a chance to win, but we have to keep, we must not panic. We must not be complacent, of course, because we cannot just sit at the sidelines and wait for things to happen. We have to do our thing. We have to be part of this monstrous war, I suppose, and understand what's going on. If we don't understand, including the historical backdrop, if we don't understand, we won't be able to act accordingly.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with that more. Right. Alex just messaged me. Oh, sorry. Yeah, go on. No,
I was just interesting because, like, here in this, you know, what we had as an information beforehand, like you mentioned various types of warfare, like this social engineering, manipulation kind of, and like economic warfare, and then also this full spectrum dominance kind of ideology as a base for like controlling or like inciting war or like going that direction. Do you think this is maybe at the moment, is that all going, I mean, it's some part of it is a little bit different players, you know, as I'm like would mm-hmm. who would go for into this each direction. So do you think they have some sort of like coordination, like in the top or would they also do this like kind of contradicting one another, so having like a problem that, you know, you have various things going on at the same time, and they're even like fighting one another with these different approaches.
No, absolutely. I mean, there's a degree of incompetence, clearly, behind this as well. I mean, within this as well, you have to factor that in. I mean, just look at the fact that the disputes occurring right now, I mean, around getting all the NATO countries on board with the narrative of Russia is about to invade Ukraine. They can't even get Ukraine to get on board with that, you know, and they're the ones who put Ukraine into power in 2014. And now the Ukrainian defense minister is saying, actually, we don't really have any evidence that Russia's about to invade. That's an important player you want to have on board with the narrative. Exactly. Croatia is saying, you know, if they do this, we're not giving any soldiers in. We're not. I don't care about, you know, the collective security garbage. Germany and France are like, they don't want to be caught in the crossfire of a nuclear war. And so they've like initiated with Russia and Ukraine a revival of the Minsk agreements discussions, at least, which are moving somewhere. So there's incompetence, there's infighting, you know, there's a lot of members of the elite are realizing that it's not in their benefit to go along with this game in the context of an energy crisis where they're going to also be undermined by having Nord Stream 2 cut. And in the middle of like, Christ, we're going into an ice age for crying out loud, you know, people are going to die by just freezing to death. We need energy. And so there's infighting and I actually get a certain amount of, solace when I look at the fact that the best puppets, the best managers that the oligarchy can find to put into positions of power in the United States, like look at Anthony Blinken, look at Biden, nothing, there's nothing there, or Justin Trudeau or the defense minister of Germany. Yeah. This is the best that they could find to manage their system. I mean,
but why is that? I think that the quality of the politicians has really deteriorated over time. How is that? Is it so tough to find these people that you can still manipulate because others are not available for this anymore, or?
Well, here's the thing. My thinking on this has been that, you know, when the oligarchy deploys cultural warfare onto its victims to make the victims that they wish to suppress more susceptible to their sophistry, that involves a corruption of education, a corruption of different cultural institutions that would make people more myopic, more atomized, more hedonistic, less able to use their innate deeper powers of insight and reason. They also will tend to, as a consequence, brainwash that will touch their own progeny. And here we are, 2, 3, 4 generations after the thinkers like Bertrand Russell, H.G. Wells. And if you read the quality of writing coming out of an H.G. Wells or Bertrand Russell, that is some rigorous, disciplined stuff. Today, you don't find anything similar to that. There's a level of self-induced stupidification, which for me is only more scientific evidence that the oligarchical system itself runs contrary to the laws of nature, of nature's own law, because it can only, when it gets what it wants, as a parasite sucking on a host, it can only destroy the host and thus also destroy itself, which is where you get these periodic dark ages in various cultures throughout history, which is the consequence of the oligarchy getting what it wants as it self-destructs.
That's it. And once again, this is another case in point that proves that Professor Matthias Desmet's theory is correct. Because when we're talking about totalitarianism, it's always self-destructive. And it shows how self-destructive it is. I mean, look at our foreign minister. She is an idiot. She doesn't even know how to talk.
Yeah, I leap in on this point.
Sure.
Yes, of course, your foreign minister lied that she was a Völkerrechtlerin. She'd been to the London School of Economics, whereas the only proven fact in her CV was that she was a trampoline champion in her teens, right? No, but Matthew's taken a very important turn here because he's talking about energy. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to pitch my own stuff because Matthew has really done a superb job. And I know as a professional interpreter how hard that is to interpret. So like you yourself, Rainer, your interpreters behind the scenes are doing wonderful professional level output there. But he's talking about energy as the key thing. Now, a talk I gave a couple of years ago in London is easily found on YouTube if you search for Alternative View 9.1. It's a follow-up, obviously enough, to a talk I gave called Alternative View 9. So if you put Alex Thompson Alternative View 9.1 into YouTube, you'll find it. I call the Anglo persuasion that we've outlined today in that talk the Aristotelians, for short. And I call the progressive France List persuasion, which historically was more Prussian and early American thinking, I call that the Platonists. You have to use some terms for short. But one of the key things I bring out there, and I'm very indebted to Joseph Farrell, F-A-R-R-E-L-L, for the best research on this, he reads German and Russian, is that the Anglo elite was very interested in using the Third Reich to develop energy projects around IG Farben and then to extricate the goods of those after the war with Operation Paperclip. We have a couple of indications that they were close to what in layman's terms could be called free energy, although there's many caveats to that idea. But in other words, harvesting energy in order to defy the effects of gravity locally. We know that they were pretty close to that because they had this weapon, which was described as Kriegsentscheidend, decisive for the course of the war, which was known by the soldiers who worked on it as die Glocke or der Bienenkasten, the beehive or the bell, because it buzzed. Where did this stuff go? Well, it went to the USA, where they've pretty much admitted now that they have craft that can replicate these effects. But there's also a German tail end to this story, which is, have you ever heard of OTRAG?
No.
No. OTRAG is Orbital Transport und Raketenaktiengesellschaft. OTRAG was a 1970s German company which came up out of nowhere, suddenly got a concession for 5% of Zaire, as it was then called, under Mobutu. 5% of Zaire is the same size as the DDR. Mobutu gave them permission, this obscure Stuttgart company that produced what the Germans called Billigraketen, alternative technologies, he gave them permission to clear the natives out of their villages in this territory. And OTRAG spent their time trying to develop this alternative launch technology unexplained. Nobody really knew about this until Gorbachev blew the whistle on it. Ultimately, Gorbachev is a deep state globalist himself, right? But he, as a kind of getting his own back at the end of the Cold War, he said, oh, the Germans have their own high technology and their own space race. It's called OTRAG and it's buried in Zaire. A very obscure element, but since you're a German-based investigation, you might want to look into that, because if anyone in Germany can tie that together, you may have an indication from the personalities around that, who in Germany were the stay-behinds, who didn't go with Operation Paperclip. So others went to Britain, France, and the Soviet Union, right? The geniuses who didn't get extricated or executed, they may have developed some kind of energy technology which was allowed to be used in West Germany via this OTRAG.
Well, you know what? This is extremely interesting because right at the start of this pandemic, someone approached me in my office and told me about this secret energy project. He didn't name any names, so I don't think, because if he had, it would have sounded familiar to me when you mentioned OTRAG. But I think that's what he was talking about. The results of this must be there. That's at least what he said. I mean, he didn't claim it's from OTRAG, but it can't be any other source, in my view, from what you're saying now. I'm going to look into this. We all will.
Yeah. All I can say is if you talk to people from any serious intelligence service, like the top five would be America, Britain, France, Russia, Israel, to some extent Germany since the Second World War, they all say, well, we have a team somewhere in our national apparatus which goes around following these advanced craft. Yeah, I don't want to get into UFOs for its own sake, but let's say that the most sensible line you can take on UFOs, which is that developed by Jacques Vallée in America, Frenchman by origin, is this idea that there's military use of high technology, the principles of which were worked out in the early 20th century. The details were worked out by Third Reich physicists. The fruits of it were taken to the Allies, the Western and Soviet allies after the war. And not all of this stuff, we don't need to accept that all of this stuff is alien, right? It could be something like a high physics psychological operation to scare people and ultimately to funnel them towards one world government. But it ties into what Matthew is saying, because the ultimate game plan of what I call the Aristotelians, the Anglo-Saxon world to path to world government is, look, face it, guys, there are shortages. We need to reduce population, lower your expectations, live in poverty, etc. And the more productive line to world government would be this use of energy, as I say. So it's a very dark area, but I think the time has come to start looking seriously into it.
What do you call the other side? Aristotelia?
Yes, because Aristotle, among the Greek philosophers, very roughly speaking, or his later followers, say nature is limited and finite, and therefore we need small government. And there are good arguments to be made for this. So historically, this has been the position particularly of Protestantism and of the Anglo-Saxon world. And therefore, by that same token, also the northern half of Germany has been in this mold, right? Mm-hmm. The dominant position, though, including when Germany united in Bismarckianism, is more associated with Eurasian land powers. And that's the idea, as Matthew's outlined extremely well, that by improving our infrastructure, also known as the American system under Hamilton and later Lincoln as well, that we can actually improve our lot. Ultimately, you are facing a finite world, finite resources, but the artificial reduction of quality of life is a particular strategy of the Anglo elite, which I call the Aristotelians. Plato was much more of the idea of, yes, he did believe in an elite, quite a nasty elite in the end, but the Platonist model has been much more popular in Germany and Russia, and it's the idea that we share with the people some of the fruits of our technological research. We make them feel that we're on an advancing national project. That's early America, pre-Civil War America as well.
Yeah, can I just add one thing? I know we've overextended the time, but I would like to add a little thought to that as well. The paper that if people want to sink their teeth into this, I've become familiar with this too over the years. And I found personally that one of the most useful essay studies that I'd ever encountered that showcased the differentiation between the Aristotelian versus Platonic movements throughout the ages was a 1978 document that I had found. I'm sure people can get it easily by just typing "secrets known only to the inner elites" by the late American economist Lyndon LaRouche. He died in 2019. Mm-hmm. But that work was a fantastic study on universal history as understood by a battle between opposing paradigms of elites that see the world, that see human nature in very different ways, with the Aristotelian being much more based upon an idea of empiricism that, you know, in the Aristotle world, truth is located through defining things in a crystallized way. If you want to know what justice is, well, Aristotle will tell you there's a justice for the slave, a justice for the master. And he will also say that master-slave relations are built into nature. That is, you know, whereas in the Plato world, it's much more process, verb oriented, where there's never a solid crystallized answer provided in any of the Platonic dialogues. They're given as a form of inquiry into paradox and seeing where your own hypotheses break down when pressed up against reality. And so in the Platonic world, you could have things like the Meno dialogue with a child who's a slave demonstrating greater powers of creativity and reason than the slave master, Meno himself, who's not able to do a very basic geometric proof that the slave boy is able to do. And in so doing, he's demonstrating the obsolescence of the elitist master-slave structure without getting at it directly. And when you look at the writings of Benjamin Franklin or any of the founding fathers or many of the people who make history happen in an upward and, you know, positive way, you'll find a platonic understanding or modality.
And of course, Lyndon LaRouche, who was very keen on America to go into space for peaceful purposes as well, died a couple of years ago. His widow, Helga Zepp, is still very much in the German political scene. And she has a group around her who are very keen on rediscovering the potential of classical music and the legacy of Schiller, the positive side of the German Enlightenment. So I find that those people have a lot of good stuff to say. As a Christian and in many other ways, I don't like some of the conclusions they come to. I have to be honest about that. But they were some of the first and the boldest in the 1970s, the LaRouche movement, to say that the British Crown had a corporate underbelly that made its money from sexual slavery and drugs. And they were proved absolutely right time and again.
Oh, my God.
Well, it's really crazy. I get a very strong Matrix feeling here. that it's really like, I don't know, like where we are at this point. And I do know, I remember Nick Bostrom. I mean, he's a transhumanist, but I thought it was an interesting concept that he once, like in a in an article proposed, or, you know, that we might be living in an ancestor simulation, so that in the our ancestors might have set up a computer game now playing their own past, and for some reason it feels very surreal right now. I mean, listening to all that, you know, what I just a short remark I wanted to make on this creativity thing. You know, I think it's I see this like that we have to tighten our belly and our belts, sorry, to and not to to you know what Ida Orkin says, I own nothing and I'll be so happy about it. I think this is also a little bit an attack on like creativity of humankind, because I mean, okay, if I don't own anything, I don't believe in consumerism, obviously, you know, but it's not only that you own stuff to consume, but it's also that you need to own stuff to, or have access to stuff to create things. And I think we as a humankind, we're also, you know, we have a strong impetus, I think, to resolve also like physical, like real problems that are around us. And for that, you know, like interfering with nature, or like working with nature. And if you don't have any materials to do that, you're completely independent, completely dependent on like the stuff that others provide for you. And I think we're not only there to produce like creativity, creative things like with our heads, like, I mean, you know, creating like text and figures or like formulas or so, but I mean, we've come to this world with a body. We're not just a beam of light. So I think it's really like what we are supposed to do is also to take the world, but not in like exploiting it or like killing it, but like sort of making use of what the world has to offer to us, and like create social sculptures and create things also with a head, like involving a body. And that's what,
and indeed, this Indiana, killing that, that's us. Why. Well, even though having grown up in a British and a Protestant context, I was predisposed in my education to believe the Aristotelian view of history, and you know, there's perennial shortages of everything and whatever. In the end, as I said in my Alternative View 9.1 talk, I regard it as a more godless kind of elitism than any Prussian or Platonist kind. Ultimately, it despises the physicality, or sometimes in English we call it the corporeal, the bodily nature of mankind. We go right back to Gnosticism and Hermeticism, the ancient mystery religions here, because they despise the physicality of God's creation. And they say that the game plan is to become uploaded into the cloud, as they would now say, you know, that leave our bodies behind us. And to the extent that bodies are useful, they're only useful because we can then possess the bodies of the plebs and make them our slaves. Yeah, that's a long-term satanic plan. So even the worst that the Prussian model can be, you know, with totalitarianism, it's still not as bad as rule by this Aristotelian creation denying agenda.
I agree.
And if you look at the writings of Saint Paul within the Bible, there's concepts that are very clear that all is spirit. You know, that what we perceive to be matter, taking it from the opposite standpoint, that in fact there is no dichotomy between the spiritual and the material world. That matter itself is one particular state within an otherwise spiritual existence. There's no empty space between objects with forces pushing or pulling the way a Newtonian or an Aristotelian would presume based on your five senses. That truth is not within your five senses. Empty space is an illusion. And it's true, right? When you actually, as we've discovered more of an appreciation for the full electromagnetic spectrum outside of that small bandwidth of what the eye picks up, there is an ocean of different plasma, of cosmic radiation, of different radiations, all throughout all of between the planets, between the galaxies. And I mean, why are galaxies organized in these beautiful spiral golden sections patterns, right? And we're told, no, it's all made up of these randomized stochastic atoms that have no purpose, no rhyme, no rhythm, that just randomly move, but that make up these macro states of beautiful order, which is just an illusion. It's like, no, actually, there's probably some coherence between galaxy formation and atomic behavior, and everything in between, and how the human mind uniquely is able to synthesize understandings and willfully modify or tune our souls and our behavior in accordance with what we discover and transmit that to future generations. Animals are great, but they don't do that. You know, like, they just don't have access to that. They're good for what they are. They're wonderful creations, but we have this other capability. And when we try to impose the law of the jungle onto ourselves, we become depressed, we become imperial, we become unhappy, we fall out of our nature because we're not creatures of the jungle as such.
You know, I can't resist quoting Heinrich Heine here, because one of the darkest periods in German history was just before the 1848 liberal revolution. And in that period, Heine wrote Deutschland ein Wintermärchen. Yeah. And it looked like Germany was never going to become a modern state and compete with the British and the Americans on level terms, right? And he wrote this wonderful quatrain: Franzosen und Russen gehört das Land, das Meer gehört den Briten. Wir aber besitzen im Luftreich des Traums die Herrschaft unbestritten. Right, which beautifully describes that, you know, you've got to expand in the mind. You've got to imagine the potential. That's Matthew's thumbnail sketch of the whole Platonic worldview, is see the potential in creation and exploit it, rather than just say, you know, we are predestined to be slaves.
That's what it's all about. If we're really going to move into, and I don't think we will, I'm certain we won't, into digitalism and transhumanism, it's the end of creativity. I think I've told this story before. I have a brother in the U.S. who is was a banker, and some 16 years ago or so, he was so sick and tired of selling these financial instruments, which nobody understands, caps and swaps and other complicated stuff, to CFOs of major corporations who didn't know what they were buying, but who didn't dare ask any questions because they felt, if I ask a question, then he knows that I don't understand. And he said, even I didn't understand. We were just selling shit, making money out of shit. And he told my father at that time, my father was helping him in his garden, rolling huge rocks around. He said, this is what I really like. When I come home at night, this is creativity. At the end of the day, meaning at the end of the night, I can see what I have created. And what I do at the bank is nothing. I'm not creating anything. I'm destroying people. And that's when he decided to leave the banking industry.
Yeah, this is true of all of us on the UK column core team to some extent, most particularly Mike Robinson and myself, because he left the City of London and I left British intelligence after an elite education. And both of us found that in the modern British setup, when you get to the top of the tree, you're amongst guys who boast that they sell shit. I would put it as bluntly as that, because that's what they're proud of. From public school, which is boarding school, to Oxbridge, the whole model is, well, the best you can do is go into a bank and sell shit and sell slavery. And, you know, that's not what we used to be historically, but that's because we've made that the be-all and end-all of our political role and the empire we still run. It's time for us to dismantle that.
Yes. And I think we're on track as far as that's concerned.
I think they shouldn't be selling shit, but they should, or we have the the task to turn shit into gold. And I think as a humankind, I think we're on a good way to do that.
Okay. Well, I thank you both. This was, again, very, very enlightening. And I'm absolutely convinced that our viewers feel the same way, because we need this kind of information in order to be able to see the full picture, not just pieces of the puzzle, but the whole picture of how they're trying to basically fool us, creating illusions all the time, and make us do what we don't want to do. Once we realize that the enemy is not the vaccinated or the unvaccinated or the Russians or the Chinese or whoever, it's those people who are using us, using some of us as puppets. They're the real enemy, but we're on to them. We're on to them. Okay, well, Alex and Matthew, I'm very, very grateful. Thank you so much. Again, we'll be in touch.
Great.
Thank you.
Bye. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Yep, thank you.